I was baptized in a swimming pool when I was 15. I grew up among Baptist types, and that is how they did it. Water, it's all you needed, deep enough to be dunked in. It was in Alicia Menard's pool, just up the road from our house. Alicia and I were the same age. We grew up in church together, spent a number of years in the same school. I had a crush on Alicia Menard from about the age of 4. It was a secret crush, meaning I didn't speak about it, but that may have been the only secret part about it. Nonetheless, I was baptized in Alicia Menard's pool on a Sunday afternoon in front of the church as they gathered around this chlorinated body of water sometime in July, in that 6-week window when owning a swimming pool in Western New York is thought to be a good idea. Believer's baptism, it was called, locating the meaningfulness of baptism in one's decision to follow Christ, in one's willingness to publicly profess one's faith through baptism. You see, evangelicals and Baptists and other Western-thinking folks, not unlike ourselves, tend to be squeamish about rituals. So we try to suck all the magic out of them. Back in Western New York, it was clear that part of the reason for this is that we didn't want to be like the Catholics. So the emphasis was always on belief and sincerity and decisions and character and the like. So at 15, I publicly declared my commitment and affection for the Christ before the church in Alicia Menard's pool. I publicly professed what was considered to be already true, that I was following Christ. Now, the question around such things as baptism, it seems to me, is this. Is it meaningful in what it reflects, or is it meaningful in what it enacts, makes happen? When I was dunked in the chlorinated waters by Pastor English, it was seen to be a reflection of commitments already made. It reflected something. But it also enacted something as well. I was no longer just a kid of church members. I was now a member myself. It enacted a transition. We Western thinkers who tend to be low on ritual usually emphasize what an act reflects more than what it enacts because we don't believe in the magic of it. But I think that the tradition that John the Baptist is coming from, the tradition where the Jordan River is this important space, this boundary to the promised land, where the Jordan Valley is this kind of wilderness where one goes out into. I think there's a considerable emphasis on what John's baptism enacts. See, baptism for John and for the many who came out to him in the wilderness there, even Jesus who chooses to be baptized by John, that this act reflects their commitments and concerns for God's people and the covenant and this desire to be a faithful people in the land, but it also enacts something. It puts in place, it reinforces a sense of a new commitment, a new direction, a willingness and a readiness to be available to what God is doing. And furthermore, in the case of Jesus, such a ritual in the Jordan River seems to have an elevated role, more than the average Joe or Jane that was going out there to be baptized. Because such a ritual for a rising figure seems to be a type of rite of passage. A rite of passage in the sense that it usually happens in a liminal space, meaning an in-between space. You have to go out into some kind of non-normal environment. This rising figure then has to be stripped of his status for a time, which is why John has to baptize Jesus. He has to be lower in status for the moment. And by going down, being dunked in the water, and being stripped of status, you then rise up. You are returned to your stature. You are returned to normal spaces, but with a new status and a new identity. In the process of Jesus' growing and coming into his own identity, moving closer to his ministry years, he undergoes this rite of passage, this stripping of status. He's not the Messiah yet. He is a young man who will be baptized by John. And to undergo this ritual, he must go out from his hometown, go out into the Jordan Valley, and by undergoing this rite, he is then raised from the water with a new identity, a new status, one important for his own understanding and one important for others. It enacts something, and what it enacts is proclaimed in part by the voice that comes from heaven. You are my son, the beloved. In you I am well pleased. See, Jesus is becoming something new, though it is still being discerned by those around Jesus what exactly is going on. But this moment marks publicly that there are changes happening in this person, that we should view this person differently. And it enacts publicly this shift of a new status. You see, this is the part of what we rational Western thinkers lose about ritual and rites of passage, the sense of what they enact, both personally and socially. I wonder, have you ever gone through something like a rite of passage? If you have, it might have been in an organization like the Boy Scouts or the Girl Scouts, or maybe the military, perhaps. More traditional cultures have rites of passage that mark and enact transitions and changes as one grows, so that the person who undergoes a rite of passage into adulthood, for example, is no longer a child or no longer an adolescent, but they are now an adult. Now, they may still have moments when they act like a child or they act like an adolescent, but that doesn't mean they are an adolescent again, because they have been marked as an adult. Rites help form identity. They signify a change. No longer an adolescent, now an adult. This person is no longer an alien. They are a citizen. This adherent is no longer just a participant, but a member. See, rites of passages and rituals have a way of making a new reality. They mark transitions. They shape identity. Now, as evangelically influenced Western believers, we're skeptical of such things. We're more reliant on things like sincerity, performance, character, belief, and such things. But the problem is that all these things, if they are qualifiers, they require constant maintenance, constant performance. They're susceptible to constant fluctuation, liable to different standards of whether you've lived up or not. And so, if your identity as a follower of Christ is dependent on such things, then it will always be a little bit slippery. It will always be somewhat vulnerable and fluctuating, always a little bit of an insecure sense whether you're actually there or not, whether you actually belong or not, whether you're actually a member or not. But if there is a ritual enacted to mark that transition, we have something to stand on, something to point back to. You may have days when you don't feel like a citizen, but you are. You may have days when you don't feel like a child of God, but you are. You are a disciple of Christ. You are a member. You are loved. You are forgiven, marked by such transitions and words accompanying them. The ritual enacts something in view of all, which was just as important for Jesus as everybody else. That he was no longer just a young man from Nazareth, but anointed for a special purpose. He was not just a child of Mary, but a child of God, beloved. He was a child not by virtue of his performance, but by the pronouncement that comes from the clouds. Jesus was the anointed not because he proved it on that particular day, but by virtue of what God had enacted and pronounced. It is true. Certain things can't be questioned anymore because the ritual has been performed. And like becoming a citizen or a member or a minister or a deacon or an elder, it's permanent. Certain things cannot be reversed unless some new ritual is in place to enact that. So baptism in our Presbyterian tradition, while it has a little bit of a different form, has a similar emphasis and an equally valid effect. In our tradition, we tend to baptize people when they're infants or children. My kids were baptized as such.
For the emphasis in our tradition is that you are declared a child of God by virtue of the rite of passage, even though you may be a squealing little kid and you don't know what's going on. You are baptized and declared a child of God, not by your own will, but by the desire and the will of God and your parents and the community of love and support. So like it or not, you're a child of God. Certain things can't be questioned anymore because they have been enacted. So whether you turn out to be a saint or a brat, it matters not. And even on days when I am not impressed with my children's performance, I am reminded of the truths of their baptism, that they still hold, that they are loved and cherished and children of the Most High. Now, the part of our Presbyterian tradition that tends to get criticized by the pious is that it creates a sense of complacency. You don't have to do anything to earn it. The frozen chosen, they say. You don't have to work for it, and you start to assume it. Now, you may not feel the same way because it wasn't your decision to get baptized. Such disinterest and complacency, however, is, while possible, is not part of the design. Instead, we are supposed to see ourselves as living into that identity, living into the truths already proclaimed for us. We are supposed to live in gratitude for the grace already extended to us. Now, despite the Baptist emphasis on what baptism reflects, about what is proven true before the public events, as I look back on my own baptism in Alicia Menard's pool, I think it did enact something for me. It was a type of transition from being a nominal Christian to being in having an inherited faith to a type of clarified identity and commitment. I was now a follower of Christ, and I took it seriously, and it has shaped the last 30 years of my life. I compare that to my unconfessed affection for Alicia Menard, and forever remained in the realm of nebulousness and confusion. As I suspect that she knew I liked her, though she never gave the slightest hint, or at least not in a way that I picked up on, and I don't remember her ever being baptized either. She and her commitments always remained a mystery. She was elusive, the way many things unconfessed tend to remain, elusive and unsolidified, like identity and confidence and commitments and a sense of belonging and affections. The things that are not solidified and articulated tend to plague us with ongoing questions. We tend to spend a good deal of time questioning such things, whether we have, can, or will live up to expectations, our own or somebody else's. We question whether we belong, whether we are liked, whether we are loved. And this is where we need to be reminded that certain things are true because they have been enacted and pronounced, not because we feel good that day, not because we have been good enough or done the right things. It is because a voice has said, you are my child. A voice has said, you are forgiven. A voice has said, you are loved. The voice from heaven declared for Jesus his place, confirmed his new identity, and propelled him to live into that new role. So God has declared your place as well. It is true. So trust it and live like it. And all God's people said. Amen. I invite you to stand as you're able. Let's sing our hymn.